Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, climate scientist James G. Anderson returns with a clear, cogent, and even mildly optimistic discussion of climate change. Plus, we'll hear from Michael Parenti and David Rovics. I hope you'll stay tuned. Harvard climate scientist James G. Anderson returns this week, or rather, we return to a very nice interview with Anderson. Last week we heard the first part of the interview. There, Anderson stressed how so many natural processes are interconnected, or coupled. CO2 in the atmosphere, the Arctic ice mass, tornadoes in the Midwest, temperate climates in Northern Europe, wildfires in California, and whether Florida is above or below sea level, it's all connected. And a change in anything is going to cause changes, sometimes large changes, in everything else. That's why Anderson thinks the term global warming is a bad one. Global warming understates the severity of the disruption, and it understates the many dimensions of the disruption. On a somewhat encouraging note, last week Anderson argued that our country's failure to address global warming is to a large extent a matter of politics and economics. A lot of big wealthy corporations and big wealthy individuals have a vested interest in extracting and burning fossil fuels. In fact, Anderson argues that alternative energy would be better for the country's economy. Anderson doesn't downplay the problems energy conversion will create, but he implies that the political and economic power problems outweigh the technical problems. For Anderson, electricity is the power of the future and the present, and we can generate the stuff without burning hydrocarbons. It's good to hear an established mainstream figure say these things. When establishment figures talk like this, maybe more people will listen. But let's not forget that more radical figures have been saying these things for years. Radical figures such as political scientist Michael Parenti and singer David Rovics. And we shall hear from both of them today, if the gods permit. But first, let us return to James Anderson. The first question he addresses is whether living in Boston shaped his understanding of climate change.
Well, the immediate answer to that question is that I'm in chemistry, chemical biology department, earth and planetary sciences department, and the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard. So this is a profoundly rich mixture of colleagues who understand these issues end to end. And then there's the Harvard University Center for the Environment that couples science into the Kennedy School, Law School, Business School, Medical School, School of Public Health. And the way in which that links into economics and politics and joins science, economics, and politics together is a really unique opportunity. So there's that aspect to it. And then when you live on the coast, you realize that sea level rise, which is inexorably coming from the melting of glacial systems, particularly in Greenland and the West Antarctic ice shelf, you realize how vulnerable coastal cities are. And Harvard is investing billions of dollars to build a new campus just across the Charles River that's only a meter and a half above sea level. Well, the nominal forecast for sea level rise by the end of the century, only a quarter of the length of time Harvard has been a university, is somewhere between 2 and 3 meters with a tail running out to 6 to 7 meters. So immediately building in Alston raises the question, well, what's going to happen when sea level rises and those buildings start to go underwater? So yeah, Boston is a fantastic place to study climate.
Many scientists have tried to find a way to measure change in climate change, but one of the most notable, I think, is that they suggested to try to use average global temperature to measure the change. Do you think this is a correct way to measure?
No, I think it's the least articulate way of studying what's occurring, because when you look at global mean temperature, the dominant control over global mean temperature involves the inflow of heat into the ocean and into the land mass and into the ice systems. Well, the oceans cover 70% of the area of the Earth, and they have an average depth of 3,500 meters, and they have massive heat capacity, the oceans, that is. So a lot of heat can pour into the ocean before there's any measurable temperature change. The thing you have to look at is the measure the flow of heat into, for example, the ice structures, the cryospheric system, and you realize that tiny, tiny amount of inflow of heat can completely destroy the ice systems, because the heat of fusion of water is so small that all of these ice systems are profoundly delicate. And so defining this in terms of the increase in global mean temperature is the worst way to describe the severity of the problem.
For yourself, what do you think is the best thing to do to prevent global warming for now?
Well, there actually, when you look at the numbers on the rate of onset of, for example, the loss of ice systems in the Arctic, and you look at the paleo record, where you track the relationship between ice systems, global climate structure, temperature, and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere from, say, the Eocene 40 million years ago, you come to the very immediate quantitative conclusion that three things are going to be necessary. We have to terminate adding more CO2 to the atmosphere, because we're now at 400 parts per million of CO2, but we have to add another 90 parts per million from the combination of methane, N2O, and CFCs. So we're at almost 500 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. At 500 parts per million CO2, the paleo record shows that there are no ice structures in the northern hemisphere at that level. And when you destroy the ice structures in the northern hemisphere, you destroy the temperature difference between the equator and the pole that drives the fundamental climate structure. So that tells you immediately that you have to do three things. You have to stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere and methane and N2O immediately. You have to draw CO2 back down below 300 parts per million to reach a stable state. And then you have to cool the planet to reform those ice structures. And you have to do that very, very gently. But all three of those are required. And that's just an unfortunate fact.
How would you convince people to believe that we are causing global warming?
Well, first of all, I think this is always an issue about generational investment for the next generation. That's just human nature, and it's a very important point that you make, that a lot of people would say, well, look, rather than making an intelligent decision to switch to solar renewables and wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, let's just continue to burn fossil fuels and create instabilities for not just our grandchildren, but for our children, because the U.S. military is a very important organization to look at. They deem climate change as equally destabilizing as nuclear armaments. And so that determines the seriousness of the problem, because the military has to be responsible quite often, ultimately, for political instability worldwide. We always move in with the military, sometimes effectively, sometimes not. So there's that aspect to it. But that brings us back to the question of the degree of irrefutability of the information that we have on climate change. And here is where two institutions have failed us. One is the government strategic structure for analyzing the physics and chemistry of climate change. because there are many, many observations that are required that will profoundly point out how serious the problem is and how rapidly things are changing. For example, we have limited ocean observations of the flow of heat in underneath the Arctic ice cap, the West Antarctic ice shelf. We have very limited observations about the coupling of severe storms into the stratosphere to destroy ozone. We don't understand the physics of deep convective storms that generates this convective injection that is responsible for very intense storms over the United States. We have no forecasts of drought. We don't know if the California drought is going to last 2 years, 20 years, 200 years, or 2,000 years. We simply don't have the forecasts. We don't have a forecast of sea level rise that's trusted. So we have a huge breakdown in the viability of our research structure related to defining quantitatively climate change. And until we make even a modest investment in that, we'll never have the information. The second aspect, the second institution that's culpable are the universities, for the point I made before. The curricula in universities across the country, and there are 2 million students that graduate from U.S. universities each year, they walk away the morning of their graduation with a diploma without the faintest idea what the fundamental facts are in the linkage between climate and energy generation. And so they're susceptible to misinformation by the fossil fuel industry. If you watch a presidential primary debate, and you know the facts around energy and climate, you're shocked by the completely fallacious answers that come out of presidential candidates' mouths. And ostensibly, this is run by a journalistic institution that is organizing the debate. But the journalists involved in this don't know the facts themselves to call the candidates on misinformation. So the government and the federal research structure has to step up and deal with the scope and the scale of climate change through a research program that's actually capable of diagnosing specifically what's going on, and the universities have to step up and develop curricula that produces knowledge in those graduates, 2 million a year, that allows them to make clear, concise judgments about the future. And of course, those students have a couple of parents, so when they come home in the middle of term and the parents say, well, what did you learn this term for my $40,000? Those students can come back and they can say, well, I understand this about climate structure and I understand that about primary energy generation, and these are facts that need to be acted on. So in fact, it's 6 million people a year affected by a good university curriculum. And 10 times 6, that's 60 million people in a decade. Universities have to step up and take responsibility for that.
How vulnerable do you think we are towards climate change right now? Yeah.
Well, we're profoundly vulnerable. Look at what's happening in California, and look what's happening in the Northwest. The Columbia River Basin has less snowpack this year than any time in recorded history. The frequency and intensity of severe storms that sets in April and runs all the way through August, that creates a belt from Oklahoma to Wisconsin for severe storms that's doing terrible damage. The frequency and intensity are increasing. Sea level rise is increasing, but so too are severe storms that bring storm surges to the coast. You look at Norfolk, Virginia, for example, which is a major naval base, it's now under serious duress in rising water. The entire southern third of Florida goes underwater with just a 3 meter sea level rise. So I think we have a profound problem because all of this is irreversible. We can't just stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere. We've already loaded it to the degree where these events are inexorable.
Do you think that climate change in an overall scale is still a debatable topic?
No, only amongst the uninformed. It's only viewed as a debatable topic because of the misinformation that's pumped into the system by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, not only do they spend billions of dollars on misinformation, they support candidates who deny climate change, and that keeps the debate open. It's very similar to what happened during the tobacco smoking lung cancer era in this country, where the tobacco industry did everything it could to cast doubt on the relationship between smoking and lung cancer. And it delayed action on cigarette smoking by decades. And it's, in fact, Naomi Oreskes has demonstrated in her book, Merchants of Doubt, that not only are the same tactics being applied to climate denial, but the same people are at the center of developing that strategy to inject misinformation into the system. So it appears to be a debate, when in fact it's not a debate.
At the same time as they were going nuts building highways around the U.S. and to a somewhat lesser extent all over Europe and elsewhere in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they were also building nuclear reactors all over the place. All the countries that could afford to were doing it, pretty much. Denmark being an exception. And the exception was the cause of a mass movement. Just like the highway here. It was in the 1970s. The fuel crisis had begun. The choices were presented to us, as if we had none. Leaders of industry say that they could solve the problem by mastering the power of the radioactive atom. Some folks in Western Jutland got a notion in their heads. They thought there might be something they could offer up instead. A few hundred people gathered at a little place called Tvind and declared their will to harness the power of the wind. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. Some of them were scientists, the vast majority were not. But they knew with years of effort, you could do a lot. Word about the project spread far and wide. 100,000 visitors came to help and to advise. Until one day these windmill builders drove in with a crane and lifted up their giant wings with a mighty chain. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill. When Tvind Kraft was completed, it reached up to the sky. Its wings churned in the air at 54 meters high. The critics all fell silent. No one now was jeering, as even industry agreed. This was some damn fine engineering. The wind regaled Jutland from the North Atlantic Sea as it was seamlessly converted into electricity. It was power for the people, leukemia for none, when they declared in Denmark, just south of the midnight sun. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. They gave away the patents. They said knowledge should be free. And their plans were copied by a newborn industry. Soon Denmark would be known as a windmill building nation. And it all started with some hippies at the Tvind Kraft power station. Debates were held in parliament about which way things should go. Build a nuclear reactor, the majority said no. It could have gone quite differently. In much of the world it did. Except for those in Ulfbo, who said we're getting off the grid. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world.
David Rovics with a true story of wind-powered electricity in Denmark, a much saner alternative to nuclear energy. Here are two of the 98 good arguments against nuclear. One, nuclear electricity is not and has never been economically competitive compared with electricity generated by coal, oil, or natural gas. And today, it's also not competitive with solar and possibly wind-generated electricity either. Two, a huge amount of fossil fuels are burned to extract, refine, and concentrate the uranium used as nuclear fuel. The ultimate carbon footprint of nuclear power is just as dirty as that of coal power. Nuclear power is neither a clean nor a viable alternative to anything. But I digress. Today, even much of the establishment has turned against fossil fuels and climate change. It's about time. Typically, Michael Parenti beat them to it by a decade or two. Here is a studio recording Parenti made in 2006. It's called Eco-Apocalypse.
Eco-apocalypse. The life support systems of the entire ecosphere, the planet's thin skin of air, water, and topsoil, are threatened by global warming, ozone depletion, and overpopulation. Global warming is caused by tropical deforestation, power plants, and most of all, motor vehicle exhaust and other fossil fuel emissions that hold the Earth's heat in and create a greenhouse effect, trapping the heat close to the Earth's surface. International panels of scientific experts have voiced their alarm at the accelerated rate of destabilizing climate changes. And what do we have in the U.S.? We have such dangerous fools as former Senator Steve Symes, Republican of Idaho, who said that if he had to choose between capitalism and ecology, he would choose capitalism. The senator doesn't get it, does he? Without a viable ecology, there will be no isms of any kind to choose. The 1990s were the warmest decade on record, with 1997 the warmest year of the 20th century, until 1998, which in turn was surpassed by 1999 and 2000. And the last few years, we also again getting record heats. Carbon dioxide, the most common of greenhouse gases, has increased by about 25% since the mid-1800s. These buildups are altering the climatic patterns on which we depend for our rainfall, resulting in meteorological aberrations across much of the planet, including record hurricanes and windstorms. Global warming is causing the Arctic ice caps and the Greenland glaciers to melt at an accelerated rate, affecting a rise in sea levels that is already beginning to inundate shorelines and small islands and bring severe floods, droughts, and disrupting natural ecosystems. In northern climates, as well as warmer ones, rising temperatures have diminished soil moisture, thereby disrupting the ability of forests to renew themselves and contributing to more forest fires. Global warming is playing havoc with the breeding habits of wildlife and threatening species with extinction through the release of new viruses and increased vulnerability to disease. Global warming also puts humans at risk by inflicting more heat, stress, air pollution, infectious disease, and droughts. Unless we can move away from fossil fuels and toward wind and solar power, the the compounding effects of global warming are likely to bring utter disaster to the entire planet. Another potential catastrophe is the shrinkage of the ozone layer that shields us from the sun's deadliest rays. About 2.6 billion pounds of ozone-depleting chemicals, chiefly chlorofluorocarbons, are emitted into the Earth's atmosphere every year. The top five CFC polluters in the United States are corporate military contractors. U.S. space shuttles also have disastrously damaging effects on the ozone layer. Yet the space program goes on and on. Capitalism's modus operandi is to produce and sell at an ever-expanding rate, treating the world's resources as limitlessly expendable. But the Earth is finite, as is its water supply, oxygen, topsoil, an ability to absorb toxins, an ability to absorb heat from energy consumption. An infinitely expanding capitalism and a fragile, finite ecology appear to be on a calamitous collision course. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
Michael Parenti, Eco-Apocalypse, from a decade back. Preceding that were David Rovics, singing in Boston in January 2013, very nicely recorded by Chuck Rosina. And before that, Harvard scientist James G. Anderson. And many thanks to Dale Lehman for the original recording. Many thanks to you, too, for listening to New World Notes. And to the good folks at WWUH-FM in West Hartford, Connecticut. And the good folks at other community stations that carry this show. For instance, station KRFP-FM, Radio Free Moscow, that beacon of light in darkest Idaho. Thanks, too, to the good folks at RadioForAll.net, who make recordings of the show easily available to listeners and to radio stations worldwide. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, keep the aspidistra flying, remember you are not alone, and please come back again next week. Ciao.